Peoples. I'm Jill Ajizi, and you're listening to Family Matters. I serve on the board of PAAO, and I'm very proud to be a member of working very hard to change the way of thinking about parental alienation internationally. And tonight, I want to welcome Judge Michelle Lorance, my co-host. She has spent 20 years as a domestic relations lawyer and has been a domestic relations judge in Circuit Court of Cook County since 1995. She was raised by her grandparents as a child of divorce, and she has also been through a divorce herself. She has devoted her professional life to helping those who are similarly situated. She is caring, compassionate, wonderful, and I'm proud to call her one of my very dear friends. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you very much for saying that, Jill. It's great to be here with you.
Michelle, I want to talk about something that we've both been working very hard on for the last 6 months. I had a book come out on January 6th called The Look of Love, a novel about divorce and parental alienation. And you had, of course, your book come out the same day, The Good Karma Divorce. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes, but before I tell you about the book, I want to just tell the listeners about the synergy of you and I becoming friends.
Ah, okay.
Not knowing about each other's book, but finding out that I wrote a book called The Good Karma Divorce, and your book is a novel about what happens when you don't have the good karma divorce. And I would have never dreamed to be able to get the real feedback. It's pretty amazing that we come together and have built this kind of friendship.
It's good karma.
So
yeah. tell me about your philosophy in the book, Michelle, and what you hope that people will glean from the information.
I have been sitting in divorce court for 15 years, and people come before me, and they're in such deep pain, and they're looking for the court to help them navigate through their pain. And when I ask the people who come in front of me, did you explain to your children about the divorce? Did you sit down together and explain to them what happened? And nobody really has. And I see the people fighting vehemently with each other, not having a clue about the destructiveness of doing this kind of thing. And I would talk to them in court, and I would tell them that your anger is going to destroy your child's ability to be happy, that if you don't form an alliance to rescue your children, the odds of their mental health being debilitated go up exponentially. They just didn't know the degree of the devastation. Because if you ask any parent, they'd say, I love my children, I would do anything to protect them, except downgrade my anger. That was my inspiration. Just to answer your question, in case people are waiting, what does this book really talk about besides state the problem? There are myths that people believe about divorce. Hurts everybody involved. Hurts them, hurts their children. And those myths are that the court system will deliver emotional justice, that the court system will fix your family at the end if you are engaged in vehement, hostile emotions. You expect that you go to court in the end, it's all going to be fixed. It isn't. You will be different by the end of the case. And if you don't pay attention to those negative emotions, you will change who you are, maybe forever.
Right. For tonight's show, we're going to be dealing with how the family court system operates, really how different things are happening than are really supposed to be, and how if there were judges like you in every family court, revolutionary thinking and compassionate and able to deal with situations that actually enter the court and qualified to be where they are, then the system would be operating as it should. But tonight, we have Dr. Michael Bohn, who devoted his life to high-conflict cuts involving parental alienation under the pretense of divorce. His goal is to help establish custody plans and parenting roles that encourage positive relationships between children and both parents. He's been working with mothers and fathers and has spent over 25 years dealing with high-conflict divorce as a therapist, expert witness, mediator, evaluator, and consultant, and is internationally known. We are glad he's here with us tonight. Welcome, Mike.
Wow. That's, I think, the nicest introduction I've ever in my life received, and I'll do my best to pay attention and try to live up to it, but it's wonderful to be with both of you.
I'm glad you're here, and I know that you gave up a birthday party for your son tonight, something that so many alienated parents, I just had my daughter's 19th birthday on Sunday, and I would have given anything to be able to have dinner with her. So I'm so pleased that you took time with us here tonight. So we're going to talk about tonight, Mike, the court system operation, and I want to know, in a perfect world, what do you think should be happening?
Well, I think the having certain default settings is probably a good way to put it. In a perfect world, the default setting should be that these children need to have both of their parents in their lives. They may be living under two roofs now, but they still need to be operating as having both of their parents in their lives. So I think that needs to be the guiding principle. And I think we're getting closer to that than we have been, but parental alienation, of course, is a big, big problem in that. And so I think being able to get the court to understand how to deal with that is very, very important. So having that as the prerequisite or the precondition of being that the court have a position that it's taken on that. And I think we're getting much closer to that by the court understanding that both parents are vitally important to the emotional survival of the child. I think every state now in the union has language that explicitly addresses the importance of which parent promotes a positive relationship between the child and the other parent. I'm not aware of any state that doesn't have that, and I think that's very, very significant.
Absolutely. The system is clearly manipulated in a situation of parental alienation. Is there a way to manipulate that system in a positive way? Let's talk about that. And then, Michelle, I want you also to comment on that, okay?
I think, yes, it can. The system, first of all, the family court system carries a bias, which it should. It's biased towards protecting children, which is well and good, but that immediately sets up things to being a little off balance. So I think the court has to counterbalance that, and it's subject to manipulation. The court has to really critique the accusations made within the context of the court, because in parental alienation cases, they're just rife with false allegations of abuse, and I think the court being more sensitive to that, which we're seeing more of now, can help to counterbalance that manipulation, really, of the system. But I think there are other things as well that I don't hear what the judge has to say.
When somebody comes to court with all the accusations of abuse, if you go to court and you allege sex abuse, it frightens the judges, and half the time, maybe 9 times out of 10, the judge is going to say, let's suspend visitation until we get to the bottom of this. It is such a grenade to throw into the courtroom.
Yes.
And
yes.
Everybody freezes and puts on their full metal vest.
Yes.
But really, what you have to try and get the judge to do is look at the context of the case. Let's look about whether or not visitation has been obstructed by the accusing parent. Suggest to your lawyer that they mention to the judge, paint the picture by numbers so that the credibility, so that you at least get the judge's attention not to fall prey to the neon of the abuse allegation and look at the total picture. Let's face it, no matter what, even in no fault state, we are still intuitively a blame-based system. People believe that blame matters. People believe that if you can blame your spouse for something, for bad parenting, for breaking up a marriage, and somehow this is going to benefit you.
It's so important what you're saying, Michelle, false allegations of abuse, because as Mike will tell us in just a second, false allegations are just one of the mainstream of parental alienation. It comes up very, very often in character assassination by the alienated parent of the target parent in court, and then you're forced to rebrand that parent, I think, Mike, when you go in to do your job, aren't you? And I want to ask you about that, and then I want you to comment on what you think we can do to educate the court and family attorneys about the significance of false allegations of abuse.
Very good question. What I have seen be successful in a classical alienation case where there are false allegations of abuse, and they're virtually ubiquitous with parental alienation cases. They are the centerpiece theme of it, the vilification of the other parent in every way, shape, imaginable. So what I've seen be successful is to get the court to begin to question the credibility of that. So in my view, as a non-lawyer, but in my view, it looks to me like the way the system works in the practice of law, it tends to fragment the case into little bits and pieces, and the judge very often doesn't really get the big picture. So I think attorneys would do very well to be able to, at every turn, sort of have a mantra about what the case is about, and what the case is about is about vilification, falsely, for the purposes of removing a parent from the child. And I think if that mantra can be kept up from the beginning, all the pieces will fit in place and the judge is more likely to get it then. Otherwise, they're just left with a fragment here, a fragment there, and it's like having 10 pieces of a jigsaw puzzle and trying to figure out what the picture is.
I like the word mantra, Dr. Bone. I like that a lot. And what you're really also saying is plant the tracking for the judge to be able to say, oh, this is happening again.
Michelle, you're saying that would be helpful for you.
The way that I think these kind of pleadings should go, and pleadings, for people who don't know, are the documents that tell the story, the legal documents, is starting to inventory the tiny little behaviors. I showed up, I was supposed to have him on his birthday. All of a sudden, he had plans with his friend. In and of itself, it happens. But when you start building that and weaving the tapestry into, well, the same thing happened on Thanksgiving, only Grandma happened to come into town. Then you have to say, Judge, look, one of these things, sure. Because you don't want to look like you are like a constant barking chihuahua. And the judge says, you again complaining. You want to say, sure, Judge, I understand. One of these things, even five of these things. But look at the pattern. It's a frightening pattern. We need you to intercede. You know, what you want to do is you want to call the judge's attention to this thing that's being orchestrated. Because, you know, we have 50 cases in a week.
And I think another way that I sort of describe it is that you basically develop a template, a very simple template, because the story of what's going on in these cases needn't be complex. It shouldn't be. It should be rather simple. And just what I said a moment ago is about vilification, it's about removal of a parent, and create a template that conveys that story, and then all the examples that can fit into the template that give it emotion, give it life, really. And you use the phrase the story. I think that's the perfect way. That's really what this has to be, is a storytelling process through the litigation process, so the judge has a chance of understanding what's really going on. I think that's...
Well, Mike, if you are successful in rebranding a parent or allowing the court to see that there is something going on, how do you feel about court appointees that may or may not be qualified to do what they're doing as, for example, a custody evaluator, giving the court then a snapshot of what's going on right now instead of looking back at the past relationship that the target parent had with that child? How do you fight haranguing of the custody evaluator's decision and reports when you're trying to rebrand the parent?
Well, I think it probably have two or three different answers. If the choices of who would be those experts have not been, that they haven't been appointed yet by the court, and you have some ability to have input into that, a very careful screening of them by someone that would really know the questions. All custody evaluators are going to present that they understand anything that people think they should understand. But they are not all created equal. There are a great many custody evaluators that really do not understand alienation and don't understand the power of it and begin to intend to think, well, gosh, this kid doesn't want to see this parent. They must have done something. So they carry that bias and they keep looking for it, and eventually they try to sort of fill in that blank or something. So I think if you have the ability to select or have input into that, I think a very careful, painstaking vetting process to do that. So that's the first thing. What I tend to do is try to find a pre-screened list of two or three qualified people in the hopes that the court will pick one of those, so the other side will look sort of silly if they don't accept any of them at all. So that's the first, the best ideal situation.
Could you talk more about how to vet, before we get off that, how do you go about, I mean, nuts and bolts about, you know, some people live in very small towns who are listening and don't have a big panel to choose from.
Exactly. I would look for, ask questions about things that may not tend to use. If I was an attorney or a parent who might be talking to the potential evaluators, I would not use the term parental alienation probably. I would describe behaviorally what's happened, and to see what they have done in cases like that in the past. This is probably not a conversation a parent could have with a potential evaluator, because that would tend to probably conflict them out. But if, as an attorney, I would think it'd be reasonable, but I would approach it that way by describing the behavior. Suddenly you've got, because you have to stress the history in these cases, and custody evaluations are not supposed to be a snapshot. It is supposed to be a historical view. They often aren't. They often are not done to the standard that they're supposed to be done, but no one critiques that. And there are standards that are pretty well accepted but not often observed. There's not a central processing or sort of a clearinghouse, it may be another way to put it, that I'm aware of. I mean, it has to do with, if I'm involved in a case on a consultative basis, I'll call and interview the potential candidates by phone and just ask them all kinds of questions about how they have dealt with these situations in the past without making reference to the specific case. And that way I get a sense of where their biases may lie in identifying who would be a good candidate and who would not be a good candidate. I was just involved in a case in another state now where there's a psychologist involved who is not really clear where they stand on this, but from just reading some bio on them and past things that they had written, I sort of have an idea about how they're going to come out, so that sort of informed us about how we have to approach this particular evaluator.
The lawyers are going to have to.
Well, yeah, I think the lawyer and the client can't do it, really. I mean, I think that's one of the roles, if you can have somebody on a consultative basis that can do those kinds of things, because the lawyers often don't really have enough time to do that.
You know what, it occurs to me as we're all talking that this is where support groups would really come in handy, because then people could really share resources.
Yes, and I think they work that way to some degree.
I think that the parental alienation world, people that have been touched by it, while it's very large, it's very small. So everybody knows where to go for those types of things and what group to seek out. There are groups like ACFC, the American Coalition for Fathers and Children, that will help you with referrals to other people. So for psychological things or family, Rorschach has a bunch of stuff on his website. So there's a lot of places that you can go to find those resources, but PAO really is just education about parental alienation, creating awareness. Look at advocacy and working with our group to help create awareness. I think that is always a great thing for people who are becoming sad and depressed and don't know where to turn at the loss of a child, that they can toward legislative change and judicial reform through PAAO and become a volunteer and become an advocate. Michelle, I want to take a question out of the chat room for you specifically, and that is, we've heard of several cases recently of parents being jailed for interference with custody, visitation, and alienating behaviors. Does that make the rounds of the courthouse in your circle of peers, and do those cases influence judges that avoid getting into the nuts and bolts of alienating behavior?
Listen, that's a breakthrough kind of case. I mean, we've heard about it once in a while, but this is a pretty significant case. I've actually mailed it out to some other judges. And after all, judges are just regular people. We want to know that somebody's doing this, that it's getting supported, that in fact that is an appropriate thing to do if it's warranted. And a case like this starts to make difference, and I'm telling you, it goes around like wildfire, because many people have had some pretty bad experience. I assume that's true. Certainly anybody who's alienated and has not felt protected by the court wouldn't believe this. But there are judges who don't like this kind of behavior, who don't like these violations, even those who don't exactly say, I believe in parent alienation. They still don't like people who are completely violating court orders and visitation orders and contact orders. So I think that's an important case, Jill.
Good, good. And as you know, in Illinois, Michelle, we have the visitation interference law, which after asking 15 of the lawyers who sit on the Illinois Family Law Study Committee with me if they've ever used it at all, because it includes fines and jail time, none of them have ever employed the visitation interference law, which I find amazing. Do you see people bring that in front of you as a form of defense or not?
I have not seen, and this is mainly the cases I get, I haven't seen one lawyer come in with invoking that law violation. I've seen plenty come in for the old traditional rule to show cause for visitation violation, but isn't that amazing? I'm not sure everybody really knows about it.
Mike, do you feel that awareness about parental alienation is growing in the family court arena because of these decisions that are coming out nationwide?
We hear about this stuff in the news. We read about it. I think the answer is yes.
Well, I hope that – I think 2010 is really going to be our year, and I think that people are really going to start to get it and understand when these people are losing their children to parental alienation. It's a very sad thing, and I'm sorry to say, I know what it feels like. I have to say, this is a call-in show, and our number to call in is 347-539-5024. And I'm going to take a call right now. Michelle, do you have a question for Mike?
I really do. Here's my question. At what stage do you know that you need to start spending some money to get an expert? A lot of people that I talk to, the beginning stages of alienation, the time when you need to set the protocol for self-defense. It's hard for one spouse to believe that this is really happening. It's
right.
Very hard in life, in any way, shape, or form, to wrap around that people could really be evil to you.
Yeah.
Could really be, because you say, I would never do something like that. I only want to support his or her relationship with the children. And they can't conceptualize
right.
that somebody else could be that malevolent if they're not. It's a hard projection. What
yes.
do you say to those people who keep wanting to defend the spouse because they can't accept that reality?
Well, frankly, by the time someone gets to me, they're sort of the dew has fallen off the lily, and they're no longer in the process of defending the spouse by the time I become involved typically. I think in the early stages there's a denial of this, and often just explaining to them about what's happening here and an eye-opener. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten emails from people that I don't know that have read certain things, because this is a very patterned process, this whole alienation thing. So you can say a lot of things with a lot of predictive value and get it right a lot of the time. So I'll get emails from people saying, oh my gosh, I think you wrote my life. You're looking in on it, and you must see these things happening. And that's not the case. The fact of the matter is it's very tightly patterned. So when you explain to them what's going on, and you can sort of hear the light bulb go on, even over the phone, I think that's the first step. Then they begin to realize that they have to recognize what's going on, and the fact that, so there's an initial denial, and then there is an awareness, but then the denial creeps back if they're still fairly emotionally connected to that other parent. It depends, but they got to be reminded.
Well, what is that all about in terms of the brain? Because are we all, is it an immaturity?
I hope not.
What would you say?
I hope not.
Because I
don't think it's immaturity. I think it's naivete, but which I don't think is the same thing
uh-huh.
as immaturity at all. I think it's a denial, really. It's a reality they don't want to digest and accept, so they just sort of look the other way.
I was going to say, looking the other way, there's also a good reason to look the other way, and that is because if you accept that reality, you're about to embark on a very expensive process.
Yes.
Getting
yes.
your expert, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think in answer to that earlier question about the expert, I think once it's clear that this is what's going on, it's very likely that you're going to have to get an expert on board. And there are different capacities. So first of all, find one that's qualified. That's not just like opening the Yellow Pages. I mean, you really have to do some investigation and some checking up on their past history in this case, in that case, et cetera. But they could be done in different capacities. They could be an appointed custody evaluator. If there's a way to do that in the particular case, they could be an expert for one party, but probably wouldn't be able to interview the other party. So that's a little less ideal, because that opens up the door to bias and accusations such as that. But then one of the other capacities that I find to be helpful is to have an expert who's really there in a more hypothetical basis to essentially educate the court and to have hypothetical questions prepared so that the expert, that are styled after the facts of the case, so they're easily recognizable, so the expert can really hypothesize about what this may mean and that may mean, so the judge can have an understanding of what's going on. Because oftentimes, I mean, I imagine what it must be like as a judge, because the judge, in my naive view, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, really, by design, probably knows less, is the person in the room, in the courtroom, that knows less about the case than anybody.
We only have
evidence.
A snapshot of what it is.
Yeah, and it has to be a snapshot, a snapshot that's filtered through the rules of evidence. So you're not going to see all the other things that people see in the hallway and on the parking lot and all that.
And people believe erroneously that we do have a lot of experience, but
mm-hmm.
that we're not the wizard,
right.
And a lot of time we don't have any magic powers. The gavel, not a magic wand.
Yes.
And we don't know. And sometimes somebody is out lawyered who
mm-hmm.
really has the side of the angels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that happens.
Yeah, I'm sure.
People
I know.
Believe that a stronger lawyer, you know, a real aggressive lawyer is better. It's not necessarily true.
Right. I agree with
that.
And
we can see through that as well. Let's create a perfect rebranding situation. Let's create
okay.
it as if money was no object. You know, it's not the direction of the wind, but where you set the sail.
Question, though, Michelle, what I'd like Mike to do, because I didn't have the opportunity to know about Mike when my problem was going on, and maybe some people don't understand what his role would be in their process. So what, Mike, what I'd like for you to do is just walk us through what you do from beginning to end. Now, I know, I understand that sometimes you get involved in cases where they're already all screwed up and you've got to redo all of that. But tell me, the case that you take from its inception, how does that work? And how many hours does it take you? And cost-wise, what does that, I mean, if you want to talk about that, what does that run someone?
Well, initial part of a case where I become involved is to review whatever's happened. I mean, some cases have boxes of documents and some have almost none, depending where it occurs. So whichever the case is, of course, what has to be absorbed and digested and understood. And then what I do is begin to sort of understand the theme of the story, to use that word, of the case, about what's happened. And oftentimes in an alienation case, it is a pretty consistent story that happens over and over again in terms of vilification and et cetera, et cetera. So as those things are more clear, what I'll do is become involved in the assignment of a potential expert. We decide if we're going to use a custody evaluator. Oftentimes there are decisions about should we use a custody evaluator or a guardian ad litem, and I think there's clear preferences for one or the other in most cases, and it's important to be able to discern that. So part of what I do is just break down the case in its various pieces, parts, because there are lots of moving parts, and get them all kind of working together, again, to convey that single theme, that mantra, so every time it goes into the courtroom, there's a familiar sense of it as far as what's happening. Because if the story is correct, everything will fit together and it will make sense. Because so many of these cases, things don't make sense. But when you've got it in terms of the theme of the vilification for the purposes of elimination of that parent from the child, and that becomes clear early on, all the pieces fit very well. So I'll meet with the party. I will review all the documents. I may have contact with any psychological experts that have been involved in the case. I'll talk to people that are basically try to find people that we may want to testify. I may talk to the guardian or the parenting coordinator if there have been those involved in the case. And basically, with the goal of trying to present this ultimately to the court in a way that gets a remedy. One of the things I always stress is you never want to take a problem to the court where you don't also take a solution for that problem to the court. Gets back to what you were saying earlier, Michelle, that people come there thinking that there's some magical justice is going to occur, and that's just naive. That's not how it works. You have to present a problem, make it very succinct and concise, and then present a solution to the problem. Give the judge enough to be able to feel confident that if they're going to say the child who says they don't want to be with mom needs to be with mom anyway, the judge has to have confidence that that's the right thing to do. So you have to present an overwhelming amount of evidence that tells the story, that shows this example of how this person was vilified, and all these DCF reports that falsely accuse a parent of something, all of which are unfounded. And attempts, when someone is accused of sexually molesting someone, that can go to prison for that. And that needs to be exposed. And that part of the story is what kind of a parent would want their child to believe they've been molested by their other parent? What kind of a parent would want their child to believe that they were hurt by their other parent? I mean, that's egregious, and that's the most serious kind of abuse I can imagine. So as we present it in the court, all those pieces would be there so that the judge is emotionally involved in the case and takes the position of being protective of that parent. That's the goal. That's the promised land right there. So that's what we aim for.
Okay.
I just want to say something about guardian ad litem versus attorney for the child so people know. I'd like your both of you to, if Jill has an opinion, or the guardian ad litem gets to tell the court their perception. An attorney for the child technically advocates the position that the child wants. If the child's alienated and it's a court-appointed attorney for the child, in a way, and the child doesn't want to go with dad, the lawyer has to say, well, you know, the child doesn't want to go with dad. But if it's a guardian ad litem, the guardian ad litem can say, the child doesn't want to go with dad, but I think there's much more here, and I'm going to report it to the court. Don't you like the guardian ad litem better in these cases?
Yes, but I still think that the guardian ad litem is much more likely to take uncritically the alienated child's protest about seeing the parent. I mean, in most cases, the guardians, unless they really understand this very well, and there's some wonderful guardians that do understand this very well, but most will tend to be swayed by the protest of the child. That's why I tend to favor a more custodial evaluation.
You mean more so than, in Illinois?
Not more so than an attorney ad litem. No, I think that the attorney ad litem, my understanding is that their job is to zealously represent the wishes of the child.
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be made clear to the court that this child, it's like saying, this child wants to go out and smoke crack and have unprotected sex. You need to have an attorney hired to be able to let them do that.
To allow them to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
In my case, my daughter was allowed to do whatever she wanted by her court-appointed advocate that I paid half of a bill of $47,000 to so that she didn't have to see me. I mean, basically, that's what it boiled down to. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate that some of these people have really made a cottage industry out of being on the list and being appointed to represent these kids. It's very, very sad, and many of them don't have the credentials to deal with these children that are so incredibly just twisted by parental alienation. It's a very, very sad situation.
And one of the things that's a corollary to that, but I think it can be dealt with, is there is as I describe it, there's sort of a collegial relationship between at the courthouse between the various disciplines, the judges, the attorneys especially, the forensic psychologists, the guardians. I mean, everybody knows everybody, typically. And the cases come and go, but this collegial group sort of is always there. And I think that has an impact. I mean, I think it really does have an impact, but I believe in terms of representation or helping a case like this to be clear, when there has been an improper job done, if there hasn't been adequate investigation about why this child is saying they feel this way, I think that has to be really exposed. And I think there's sometimes a reticence to do that, because that means you have to essentially kind of go after the person that's saying, no, that they shouldn't have to because they don't want to. I think that has to be exposed as being outrageous.
I think you're right, Mike. And I want to tell you, the chat room is just burning up right now with people talking about custody evaluators and GALs being qualified to do what they do. Well, I mean, basically, they're just saying that they've been failed. Most of these people have been failed by that system. And why aren't these people trained in parental alienation? Why don't they understand that it is a real problem? And why are they not held to a higher standard when they are supposed to be protecting our children? And what do we do? I know in the Illinois Family Law Study Committee, 3 weeks ago in our meeting, we discussed making stricter continuing education credits for those particular people, because they are dealing with our children, with our future. And this is something that is extremely, extremely serious. We are looking at a whole country full of kids that are going to be so incredibly screwed up unless these people who are dealing with them in divorce situations, because we're not going to stop that, I don't think. Right. We have to help these kids.
Just in defense of Cook County, just because it's important just to have all the information.
Yes.
And believe me, I think that it's all got to be in the parent educating as much as anybody, because they're the ones who can do it. If they want to, they can get around any court in the world just about. If they're that malevolent and there's not a lot of money there to stop them, you know that. So, but back to that, in Cook County, to be a child advocate of any sort, child rep, child representative, guardian ad litem, you have to take all kinds of continuing education. And we even had Dr. Warshak. I mean, we're training these people to do it. We just don't let anybody do it. Now, does this mean that they listen? I don't know. But we've got a really good batch of child rep in Cook County. We really educate.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm aware of a different state, Ohio, for example, has recently really done a very good job of redoing their entire guardian ad litem program. And back to your question earlier, Michelle, about the role of an attorney ad litem versus a guardian ad litem. If the guardian in this new program, that I think it's in statutory language now in Ohio, if there is a discrepancy between what the guardian ad litem, in other words, what the child proclaims to want, and what the attorney ad litem and the guardian ad litem feels is not in the best interest of the child, that becomes a focal point and not just something that's just an afterthought. It becomes really like we have to evaluate this. So I think there's been some real improvements made. There's a long way to go, and some areas are much more evolved than others. In the state of Florida, for example, there's some jurisdictions where guardian ad litems are basically volunteers that have almost no training at all. It varies a lot in any given area.
What about parent coordinators? They have enormous amount of power. They have no credentials.
Yeah.
And that's a little tricky too, if you ask me.
Yeah, no, it's
I think you got to really look at that.
Yeah, I agree. The way parenting coordinators are supposed to work, they're supposed to be referees. They're supposed to have a rule book like a parenting plan with clear guidelines, and then it's a way to avoid going to court and resolve things at a quicker, more at a lower level. But unfortunately, when a great many parenting coordinators have a mental health background, so they tend to operate more like therapists than they do referees, blowing the whistle, saying foul. No, they need to be brought here at 4 o'clock, not at 7 o'clock or something like that. So, but if the parenting coordinator does what they're really the role is supposed to be, it can be effective. But in my estimation, it's very often not done the way it's supposed to be.
We've got about 13 minutes left. And because I know there are people listening who are in the process of having parental alienation put upon them right now, and I know they're all listening, so I want to ask you, what can a parent do right now? And some of these people that are listening are well into the process, years into the process. I'm 6 years into the process. If you think you are experiencing parental alienation right now, what is the best possible avenue for you to traverse?
Well, first of all, make sure that's what's going on and to be able to review. And it's not difficult to tell that. I mean, a few questions about the history of a relationship, when things begin to go sour and so forth, can oftentimes give somebody a pretty good idea of if that's in fact what's going on. So I think that's the first. Then after that, depending where the case is, if it's in litigation, for example, or if it's during separation before litigation, then I think there are strategic things that can be done that can help mitigate the effects of that. One of the things I always tell, the dilemma that most targeted parents have early on in the process is when there's a tussle or a struggle about visitation, the targeted parent very often goes, gosh, I don't want to put my kid through that because there's a lot of turmoil at the pickup. The other parent gets all upset, and then the child's upset, and so well-meaning neighbors or relatives will say, well, gosh, just give it a break because it's hard on the kid. And in 99 times out of 100, that's not very good advice because the first thing you want to do is maintain contact. So that would be the first bit of strategic choice that I would advise is you need to maintain contact with your child as best you can. Even though it may appear to put more crisis on the table, it really isn't. The crisis happens when you're not having contact with them. As
for
Amy
the
Baker, I think.
For the child.
Exactly.
Even
you know,
though it puts the pressure on the child, because a lot of parents say, I don't want to do that to my kid, I'm just not going to come around.
Yeah, and I think that's, if alienation is not going on, I mean, parents get angry with each other in divorce and it doesn't turn into alienation always. Mm-hmm. So if that's going on, that may be wise advice, but in the case where there's a pattern of it, I would say that's not wise advice.
Okay.
Because what happens, even though the child may be upset, I'd rather see a child upset than I would lose a parent. You know, Amy Baker said, sometimes people will say, a cross-examining attorney will say to an expert, well, this child hasn't seen their other parent, but they seem to be doing fine. Why, you know, they're doing well in school, they're this and that and so forth. Why do you want to rock the boat? And I think it's Amy that came up with the point, well, the boat's not rocking, it's been hijacked, it's been stolen. And so the trauma is not about seeing the parent. The trauma is ongoing and has been from not seeing the one that they're not seeing. And that needs to be made clear, and it often isn't.
I hear that all the time. My child's making A's. He's okay without the other parent. Soccer team. And, you know, children get taller. They look like they're thriving. But the real trouble comes when they're adults in their first real love relationships. This is when it starts exploding like a geyser.
Well, and also, just to enhance that a little further, I have never seen a kid who's gone through this, an alien kid, who in some level, if you ask the right questions, you come away with the conclusion that on some level they've been taught, directly or indirectly, that the parent, the targeted parent, in some way doesn't love them. In other words, you know, they'll be told all the thousands of phone calls the targeted parent makes. Well, the child never knows about that. Most often, well, they never called. I'm sorry they didn't call. I don't know why, and things like that. I mean, those are messages that teach a child that parent doesn't love them. So that's the message I think that has to be brought to bear to the court to have the court understand that the loss of a parent is about as serious, and to be taught that parent who brought you into this world doesn't love you is about as harmful to self-esteem as just about anything can be.
So. This is the message to all the parents. not to give up, because then the child will believe what the alienating parent has been saying all along is true.
And sometimes that's going to be an overwhelmed message no matter what you do. I mean, but there are also lots of cases where, lo and behold, 5 years later, 10 years later, some years later, there's a spontaneous reunification, and I see those all the time.
Well,
you don't want your behavior as a targeted parent to in any way mimic any of the accusations about you.